You are now listening to Justice Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Justice Lit. We will continue off of Sonnet 67. We are underway, still going. Pretty strong with the Shakespeare sonnet series. And so today we'll be starting off of Sonnet 67. We have a lot to cover. I'm hoping to cover as much as we can today, and so we'll kind of start right away. But before that, I have some ads, show promos, and PSAs, and our first song of the day called Floatin' by Nicole Summerlin. So we'll be right back after this.
Write something.
Events.
Personal essays.
Anything.
Submit to Discorder magazine and then take it a step further on Hail Discordia with your hosts, Zoe
and Izzy. Hail Discordia is an audio translation of Discorder magazine. We interview writers, play music and soundscapes, and do a deep dive of each zine issue. Hail Discordia plays at 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on the third Thursday of every month on CITR 101.9 FM.
Submit something for the magazine and come onto the show. Or just tune in and listen. We promise it's worth it.
If the news are getting you down or you're tired of scrolling on your phone, Massey Books is the one-stop shop for you. A 100% Indigenous-owned business that is committed to giving back to local charities, community initiatives, and organizations, Massey Books has a vast selection of rare and unique books, as well as a diverse range of books that are from underrepresented authors. You can shop online at masseybooks.com or visit their store on 229 East Georgia Street in Chinatown. They are open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Wednesday to Saturday, and 12 to 5 from Sunday to Tuesday. Their friendly staff would love to give you a hand to find your new favorite read. Are you looking to decolonize your self-care routine? Take a trip down to Sisters Sage for a variety of handmade soaps, bath fizzies, smudge sprays, and salves infused with traditional plant medicines. Sisters Sage is an award-winning local Indigenous business run by Tsimshian and entrepreneur, activist, and community builder Lynn Marie Angus and her dog TJ. Passionate about crafting wellness products that are respectful of the land we live on, Sisters Sage is committed to a heart-centered approach to self-care as well as our collective healing. Located on 1312 Kingsway, you can drop by from Monday to Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. See you there.
There are some people that aren't into all the words. There are some people that would have you not use certain words.
Opinions expressed are solely those of the presenter and may not reflect the views of CITR Radio or the University of British Columbia.
Bad words.
Shit, piss, fuck, cocksucker, mother, and tits. Wow.
This program may contain language that some listeners find offensive. Listener discretion is advised.
Tits doesn't even belong on the list, you know?
Jake, you're back. Don't shut your face.
That was Floatin' by Nicole Summerlin. Okay, now we will go into Sonnet 67. Ah, wherefore with infection should he live, and with his presence grace impiety, that sin by him advantage should achieve, and lace itself with his society. Why should false painting imitate his cheek, and steal dead seeing of his living hue? Why should poor beauty indirectly seek roses of shadow, since his rose is true? Why should he live now nature bankrupt is, be guarded of blood to blush through lively veins? For she hath no exchequer now his, but his, and proud of many lives upon his gains. Oh, him she stores to show what wealth she had in days long since before these last so bad. Now here the poet asks why the beautiful young man should live in a society so corrupt, since his very presence gives him legitimacy. And he concludes that nature is keeping the young man alive as a reminder of the world as it used to be. So with lines 1-4, they open with a rhetorical question. And the question is, why should he, the fair youth, live among corruption? Or, in other words, live among infection? And the speaker is dismayed that the youth's pure beauty coexists with and even graces a sinful world. And so the diction here is powerful. For example, the phrase infection suggests both disease and moral decay. The phrase grace and piety implies that the presence or his presence legitimizes or beautifies wickedness. And the phrase lace itself with his society evokes the image of sin that's in a sense ornamenting itself with his presence and gaining status or allure through association with him. We could also see that the speaker fears that evil is not just surviving, but thriving by exploiting the youth's beauty. Lines 5-8, this quatrain kind of shifts focus now to artifice versus authenticity. And so the phrase false painting refers to makeup or cosmetic enhancement. And so it could also be seen as an artificial attempt to mimic natural beauty. And the phrase steal dead seeing, this phrase is a little more complex than it is. And I feel like it could suggest lifeless imitation or a sort of static visual reproduction, like a portraiture, which tries to capture what is vibrantly alive in him. Now, the rhetorical question kind of laments that others settle for imitations. And so we could see that in the phrase roses of shadow, when the real thing of his rose is present and available. And so that's that. For lines 9-12, we are now given a situation where the speaker now charges nature herself with bankruptcy. And so the phrase nature bankrupt is kind of metaphorically frames her as a failed economy and where she is depleted of beauty and vitality. And the quote, beguarded of blood, suggests the loss of life force, which emphasizes how rare genuine liveliness has become, and it's symbolized by the blood blushing veins. When she says that she has no exchequer now but his, this means that her only treasury or wealth lies in this one man. Moving on to the final couplet. Now, we get here, we get that nature preserves the youth as a relic, more like a display item or a vestige of her former glory. And so we see this in the phrase stores, which kind of suggests preservation, like a museum that keeps artifacts. Also the quote, what wealth she had, implying that beauty used to be plentiful. And that the phrase, these last so bad, gesturing to a decline or moral or aesthetic or all of these degeneration. And so that was Sonnet 67. We will move on to Sonnet 68. Thus is his cheek the map of days outworn, when beauty lived and died as flowers do now. Before these, I will not say this word because it is, in a sense, kind of prophetic, but before these something signs of fair were born, or durst inhabit on a living brow, before the golden tresses of the dead, the rite of sepultures were shown away, to live a second life on second head, ere beauty's dead fleece made another gay, in him those holy antique hours are seen, without all ornament itself and true, making no summer of another's green, robbing no old to dress his beauty new, and him as for a map doth nature store, to show false art what beauty was of yore. Now, continuing the argument of Sonnet 67, here the poet sets the natural beauty of the young man against the false art of those whose beauty depends on cosmetics and wigs. And so for lines 1 to 2, the phrase his cheek is a metaphor for the face of a man whose beauty reflects a natural, unblemished past. And the phrase the map of days outworn suggests that his face bears the mark or essence of an earlier era and one that is now obsolete or faded. And so when we get to the last part, when beauty lived and died as flowers do now, that compares natural beauty to flowers. And so something seasonal and subject to natural decay. And so we also experience a nostalgic reverence for a time when beauty was transient but also genuine. With lines 3 to 4, the phrase durst inhabit on a living brow kind of critiques the boldness of these imposter beauties to appeal on real human faces, implying moral and aesthetic trespass. And this also reminds me of the character Duessa in Edmund Spenser's The Faerie Queen, how she metamorphizes, or she goes through a lot of metamorphoses into, I guess, beautiful woman, but in reality she's quote-unquote an old hag. And so that kind of reminds me of that. With lines 5 to 6, here the sharp image of hair being cut from the dead in the phrase golden tresses is significant, and so it kind of implies that something that should rightfully remain with them in the grave in the phrase rite of sepultures. And these lines kind of suggest a grotesque practice of taking beauty from the dead to ultimately adorn the living. Line 7 and 8, the line second life on second head kind of continues the image of repurposed beauty, literally or figuratively, and transferring from one person to another. And the quote, beauty's dead fleece, kind of echoes the classical imagery of golden fleece, here transformed into something kind of like how beauty made from what is not or what is no longer living. And so that's that. For lines 9 to 10, Now, the man described embodies a sacred and ancient beauty in the phrase holy antique hours. And so he's untouched by embellishment in the phrase without all ornament and represents the authentic and self-contained beauty. With lines 11 to 12, we are presented with the rejection of imitation or enhancement. And this man doesn't appropriate another's beauty to freshen his own. And the phrase making no summer of another's green evokes a seasonal metaphor again here, where he doesn't borrow youth in the phrase green from another to simulate vitality. The final couplet. Here, nature has preserved this man as a kind of reference model or a map for what true beauty used to look like. And we are presented with a clear contrast of false art with nature's authentic design. So that was Sonnet 68. We'll move on to Sonnet 69. Those parts of thee that the world's eye doth view want nothing that the thought of hearts can mend. All tongues, the voices of souls give thee that due, uttering bare truth, even so as foes commend. Thy outward thus with outward praise is crowned, but those same tongues that give thee that so thine own. In other sense do these praise confound by seeing farther than the eye hath shown. They look into the beauty of thy mind, and that in guess they measure by thy deeds. Then churls their thoughts, although their eyes were kind, to thy fair flower add the rank smell of weeds. But why thy odor mcchest not thy show, the soil is this that thou dost common grow. Now here the poet tells the young man that while the world praises his outwardly beauty, those who look into his inner being, as reflected in his deeds, speak of him in quite different terms. And so they ground their accusations in his having become too common. So here the opening lines praise the subject's outward appearance. And so it is perfect in the eyes of the world, and that's emphasized in the phrase want nothing, and how that means lack nothing. And the thought of hearts may refer to internal judgment or feeling. And it emphasizes that even emotional reflection cannot improve what is already flawless externally. Lines 3 and 4, here everyone, even enemies, praises the speaker's subject, suggesting a universally acknowledged beauty or virtue. And the voice of souls, the phrase voice of souls, implies sincerity and authenticity. And the word due here is significant as it means deserved praise, and the fact that even the foes commend implies this praise is not entirely empty flattery, but earned. Moving on to lines 5 and 6. Here, the external appearance is fittingly matched by outward praise, but a turning point begins with the phrase but, where the same people who praise the subject's outward or outer self also offers a more complex judgment. The phrase, give thee so thine own, reinforces that the praise is deserved, but perhaps only on the surface. With lines 7 and 8, the phrase other accents suggests a different tone or implication where people begin to question or qualify their praise. They quote-unquote see farther than the eye hath shown, meaning that they look beyond appearance into the subject's inner nature, and that suggests a dissonance between how things look and how they truly are. With lines 9 to 10, here the analysis kind of turns inward, and people assess the subject's mind or character, but only in guess. The quote in guess, they can't see it directly, so they judge based on observable behavior, in the word, the deeds. Here the implication is that the subject's actions do not match the nobility of their appearance. In lines 11 to 12, the word churls, which means rude or coarse people, kind of change their minds now. And though they were visually admiring in the phrase, eyes were kind, their deeper thoughts are critical here to note. The metaphor of a fair flower tainted by the rank smell of weeds is significant here as well, as it suggests moral or behavioral corruption, tarnishing natural beauty. The final couplet here kind of delivers the poem's judgment. There's a disjunction between appearance and reality, and the reason is that the subject is common despite their beauty and morally or intellectually ordinary, and perhaps even promiscuous or vulgar. And the soil doubles as both earth and metaphor for base nature or corruption. And that was Sonnet 69. Before we move on to Sonnet 70, I have a song to play for you guys from the one and only Vern Chichu. And so we'll be right back after this. This song is called We Used to Love Them.
Where everybody those burning homes. And the water's taking lives. And the wind is fierce and strong. Mother's crying all alone.
Welcome back. That was We Used to Love Him by Vern Chichu. We will start Sonnet 70. That thou art blamed shall not be thy defect, for slander's mark was ever yet the fair. The ornament of beauty is suspect, a crow that flies in heaven's sweetest air. So thou be good, slander doth but approve, thy worth the greater being wooed of time. For canker vice the sweetest buds doth love, and thou presence a pure unsustained prime. Thou hast passed by the ambush of young days, either not assailed or victor being charged, yet this thy praise cannot be so thy praise, to tie up envy evermore enlarged. If some suspect of ill masked not thy show, then thou alone, kingdoms of hearts should thou'st owe. Now here the poet tells the young man that the attacks on his reputation do not mean that he is flawed, since beauty always provokes such attacks. And so we could see here, I don't know if you guys may notice, but the sonnet may contradict the sonnet before, Sonnet 69, or may simply just kind of elaborate on it. And so we'll kind of take a closer look at this. These opening lines, in a sense, set up the poem's core paradox of being blamed, slandered, or criticized is not a personal failing, especially for someone beautiful. And so we could see that Shakespeare argues that slander is an inevitable companion to beauty, and the ornament of beauty, a phrase that may imply both the physical features of beauty and its public display, is always subject to suspicion. The metaphor of a crow that flies in heaven's sweetest air suggests an intrusion or disruption of ugliness or corruption of the crow within purity or perfection with the heaven's air. And so with this, we can kind of conclude that suspicion and slander cling to beauty like a blemish, regardless of actual guilt. With lines 5-8, so thou be good, slander doth but approve. Now that's significant. We could see that Shakespeare, in a sense, pivots away from what we just mentioned from the previous lines, where if the beloved is truly good, then slander ironically proves their worth. And so they are so excellent that every time, and my implication envy is drawn to them. And the phrase wooed of time suggests that their virtue is so notable, it becomes a target of time's attention. And time being a metaphor for judgment, decay, and scrutiny kind of support that as well. The phrase canker vice, a metaphor for corruption, especially desires to corrupt what is pure, such as the sweetest buds. But the beloved is presented as a pure, unsustained or unstained prime, that is untouched and uncorrupted youth, both morally and physically. And so these lines ultimately reinforce their virtue by showing it and showing how it withstands vice's allure. With lines 9-12, I'll kind of read this out loud. Thou hast passed by the ambush of young days, either not assailed or victor being charged, yet this thy praise cannot be so thy praise to tie up envy evermore enlarged. Now here we are emphasized that the beloved has emerged from youth unscathed. Either they were never tempted or resisted temptation victoriously. Nonetheless, even this praise cannot stop the envy. And we are given a personification of envy as something that constantly grows. In the phrase, evermore enlarged, and cannot be silenced, even by evidence of moral strength. And the poem sort of goes back to the idea that virtue itself attracts slander and envy, which paradoxically may increase as the beloved becomes more praiseworthy. Moving on to the final couplet. Now, here, if I give this one a read again, if some suspect of ill mask not thy show, then thou alone kingdoms of hearts shouldest owe. Now, here, the final couplet concludes that if no suspicion, suspect of ill, ever clouded the beloved's appearance, they would owe kingdoms of hearts, and so they would possess universal love and admiration. But because of the inevitable cloud and slander, complete devotion from all is prevented. And the irony is that slander is a false mark, in a sense hiding the true goodness of the beloved. Yet it's a mask beauty must wear. That was Sonnet 70. Moving on to Sonnet 71. No longer mourn for me when I am dead, then you shall hear the surly sullen bell. Give warning to the world that I am fled from this vile world with vilest worms to dwell. Nay, if you read this line, remember not the hand that writ it, for I love you so, that I in your sweet thoughts would be forgot, if thinking on me then should make you woe. Oh, if I say you look upon this verse, when I perhaps compounded am with clay, do not so much as my poor name rehearse, but let your love even with my life decay. Lest the wise world should look into your moan and mock you with me after I am gone. Now, here the poet addresses his own death and is affected on the beloved. And he urges the beloved to forget him once he is gone. Now, with the lines 1-4, we are beginning with a plea to his beloved, where more no longer than the funeral bell tolls. And so the phrase surly sullen bell sets a somber, even bitter tone, and it isn't just a neutral sign of death, but a begrudging one. And the speaker wants to be remembered only in passing, and that suggests that the act of mourning might trap the beloved in grief. His death is described not as a peaceful departure, but as an escape from a vile world, emphasizing both the harshness of life and the disgusting fate of bodily decay. With the lines 5 to 8, we are kind of given a striking turn here, where the speaker intensifies his request by suggesting that even reading his poetry should not bring the writer to mind. Now, this paradox that he writes to ask to be forgotten speaks to the selflessness of his love. He prioritizes the beloved's emotional well-being over his own legacy or remembrance. And the repeated condition of the phrase, "If thinking on me should make you woe," underscores the idea that love should not cause suffering, but if memory does, it must be relinquished. With lines 9 to 12, the phrase "compounded with clay" is a poetic way of saying that he has returned to dust, drawing on a sort of biblical imagery in the phrase "dust thou art." And again, the request is total erasure, where he kind of emphasizes to not say his name, yet love will die with him. The speaker links memory and identity in the phrase "my poor name" with love, suggesting that to forget the name is to allow the love to decay naturally. And so we also see a humility here, but also a sense of quiet dignity and restraint. The last couplet kind of delivers the poem's emotional climax and its compelling rationale, where public grief might invite ridicule. And so private grief could be made a spectacle, and love can be twisted in hindsight. And the speaker's wish to be forgotten is not only out of love and care, but also to protect the beloved's dignity. Moving on to Sonnet 72, we are kind of in a shift here, or kind of continuing off, well, not a shift to similarities in a sense. And so we'll give this one a read. "Oh, lest the world should task you to recite what merit lived in me that you should love. After my death, dear love, forget me quite, for you and me can nothing worthy prove. Unless you would despise or devise some virtuous lie to do more for me than mine own desert, and hang more praise upon deceased eye than ye guard truth would willingly impart. Oh, lest your true love may seem false in this, that you for love speak well of me untrue. My name be buried where my body is, and live no more to shame nor me nor you. For I am shamed by that which I bring forth, and so should you to love things nothing more." Now, continuing from Sonnet 71, the sonnet explains that the beloved can defend loving the poet only by speaking falsely and by giving the poet more credit than he deserves. And so, again, the beloved is urged instead to forget the poet once he is dead. In the lines 1 to 2, we're opened up with a conditional plea, which urges the beloved not to feel obligated to defend or explain their love once the speaker has died. And the verb task suggests burden or obligation, where society might pressure the beloved to justify their affection, and that implies the speaker's lack of obvious merit. This, in a sense, kind of sets up a theme of self-deprecation, where the speaker assumes his worth is questionable and that others will challenge the beloved's love as inexplicable. Lines 3 and 4, we are kind of deepening the plea here, where not only should the beloved avoid defending him, but they should forget him entirely. And the language is compelling. It has a final tone to it in the phrase, forget me quite, and that underscores a desire for total erasure. He asserts that there is nothing worthy of him that could stand up to scrutiny or justify remembrance, and that reveals a profoundly pessimistic view of his own value. With lines 5 to 6, there's a bit of a knowing tone here, as the speaker sees love's tendency to idealize, but is also skeptical of such elevation, especially after death, when flattery is common. With lines 7 and 8, we're continuing the image of false praise, describing it as hanging something on the dead, almost like funeral garlands or flattering epitaphs. The nigar truth, meaning stingy truth, personifies honesty as withholding and severe, and so the speaker insists that truth will not generously praise him, and that reinforces the idea that any good memory would be unjustified flattery. With lines 9 to 10, we are presented with the moral core of the sonnet, where the speaker fears that in trying to honor him, the beloved's sincerity might be questioned. If love compels them to lie, then true love could be mistaken for falsehood. And so we could see a tragic irony here, where love might demand loyalty and praise, but that very praise could be misinterpreted as deception. With lines 11 to 12, we are presented with the climatic wish for total obliteration. And so the speaker wants his name, his reputation, or memory or identity to die with him, to ultimately avoid causing such shame. The final couplet, it's kind of devastating, and the speaker admits that what he produces, whether it could be poetry, character, or legacy, is a source of shame to him. And so the phrase bring forth could refer to his creative output, his person, or his love, and they're all tainted by inadequacy. And we are concluded by him saying that the beloved should also be ashamed not just of the speaker, but for loving something nothing worth. That was Sonnet 72. We'll move on to Sonnet 73. What time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves or none or few do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest with makes thy love more strong, to love that will which thou must leave ere long. Here the poet describes himself as nearing the end of his life, and he imagines the beloved's love for him growing stronger in the face of that death. Lines 1 to 4 is significant, as it opens with a seasonal metaphor. The speaker likens himself to late autumn or early winter, a time when most leaves have fallen and nature approaches dormancy. And so the phrases of boughs shaking against the cold in this kind of suggests vulnerability and desolation, while the bare ruined choirs evokes a sense of Gothic imagery of a decaying church, once filled with song, birds in this sense, now empty and lifeless. And so we can get a reflection of aging and the loss of vitality here. The lines 5 to 8, We are presented with a second metaphor and how that shifts from the seasonal to the diurnal. And so the speaker is now the twilight, the dying light after sunset, and night, described as death's second self, inevitably follows. And so this movement implies that the speaker is nearing the end of life, as day fades into night, just as life fades into death. And the use of seals up all in rest, that phrase softens death into a kind of sleep, suggesting both finality and peace. The lines 9 to 12, here the speaker now compares himself to a dying fire. And so its last embers growing faintly atop the ashes of, quote-unquote, his youth. And so out of the metaphors we just said before, this could be seen as the most intimate and bodily of all the metaphors, where fire has been both the source of warmth, life in this sense, and in burning, its own undoing. And so the paradox is that the fire is consumed with that which it was nourished by, and how that emphasizes the self-consuming nature of time and vitality, where life inevitably leads to death, just as the fuel of a fire becomes its ashes. The final couplet, the volta, is seen here, or it could be also seen as a rhetorical turn. And so the speaker suggests that recognizing mortality intensifies love. The beloved's awareness of the speaker's fading life does not diminish love, but actually deepens it. And so there's an emotional inversion here, where the certainty of loss gives rise to stronger affection. And so we'll actually give this final couplet and read one more time. This thou perceivest with makes thy love more strong, to love that well which thou must leave ere long. And so we see the emotional inversion here, where the certainty of loss gives rise to stronger affection. And the line, to love that well which thou must leave her long, encapsulates a central theme where love is heightened by transience. And so that was Sonnet 73. And we will end it here and continue on in our next episode. And so we went through a lot from 67 to 73, and so, I was happy about today. I hope everyone enjoyed it. I can kind of say now we are halfway through the series, because I believe there's 144 of these. Let me double check this one more time. There is, 154, not 144. So yeah, there's 154, so I could kind of say we are almost at the halfway mark, or at the halfway mark. And so I'm happy with how things are going. I hope you guys are thinking the same as well. Again, open to all recommendations with anything related to literature and music, so please just let me know if you guys have any suggestions or recommendations or wants. But other than that, we will end off today's episode with this. We finished off at Sonnet 73. I hope you guys have a wonderful rest of your day. My next episode will be on Wednesday again, next week at 11 a.m. So I will see you guys then. Have yourselves a wonderful rest of the day and week. And thank you all for joining me. Bye-bye.